KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Welcome. I'm Bill Radke. And also with us all this hour is Q13 Fox political analyst C.R. Douglas. Thanks for coming in.
Good afternoon.
You know a lot. And you're just so good at making me understand.
Well, aren't you nice? I follow a lot. That's our goal on Fox, is to inform viewers. So I'm here to do that with your listeners if I can.
We asked you to listen to the news with us this hour and add some context and talk about how we're solving some of these issues. So thank you for that. We begin this hour in the jungle. That is the common name for this overgrown green belt that sits between I-5 and I-90 south of downtown Seattle. It's one of the biggest unauthorized homeless encampments in the city. And last night, in case you haven't heard, there was a shooting in the jungle. We don't know everything yet. We know that two people were killed. Three are in the hospital. John Horde used to live in the jungle. He says it was terrifying.
I mean, I'm a pretty big guy, but in the darkness of the jungle, size doesn't matter. And it's like I'd hear people walking around or creeping around, and just instantly I'd wake up. And, yeah, I was in fear of my life every night, you know, a few times. You know, a couple times a night, I mean. And then I'd fall back asleep. So, yeah, I wasn't getting steady REM sleep, or, you know, the perfect sleeping pattern was going on. But, you know, I weathered the storm and made it through. You know, I went to work one day, and, well, that Friday morning I got into the jungle, looked at a couple of my workmates, said, "What are you doing after work?" They're like, "Well, nothing." I said, "Well, you're coming with me." And I crawled him into the jungle, and we packed up my camp and marched right into Nicholsville. And there I was.
John Horde got out of the jungle, but there are still a lot of people living there. This site has a long history and a contentious history in this city. Longtime homeless advocate and founder of the street newspaper Real Change, Tim Harris, says he doesn't know exactly why it's called the jungle, but he's got a guess.
The sort of last period of mass homelessness that we saw was post-Civil War. Civil War demobilization meant industrialization and created mass dispossession, and you had hobo jungles around the country. People referred to them as jungles. So, you know, my guess is that it derives from that.
Do you call it the jungle?
Yeah, everybody calls it the jungle and has for quite a while.
Quite a while, as in decades,
back to the 30s. I mean, this is the area that the Hoovervilles used to extend to. That wasn't a completely defined area, but it included this space. And when I arrived in Seattle in 94, one of the first things I got involved in was a fight around clearance of the jungle then. So that was 21 years ago, and that wasn't the first clearance. So it's been there for a long time, and it's been called the jungle, and it's been contested terrain.
Will you describe the place?
Yeah. I mean, part of it, a good part of it, actually tracks underneath the I-5 overpass, so you've got that sort of constant traffic drone sound. When you're underneath the freeway, you know, you see the freeway probably, I don't know, maybe 50 feet overhead. And there are these big pillars that go up. There's a lot of sort of, you know, shrubs and vegetation that is overgrown where there isn't concrete. There are sort of footpaths, dirt footpaths that go through it. If you walk through during the day, you're likely to see tents, but you also see evidence of people having been there and left. I think a lot of people come in during the evening and set up camp and don't leave tents there 24/7.
How clean is it kept?
Well, it depends. If there isn't attention paid to it by the city, garbage will tend to pile up.
How dangerous and criminal is this place known as the jungle?
During the day, I would watch myself as I was walking through there. During the night, I would not go in alone.
How would you describe the dynamics there? How people are treating each other?
Well, it all depends.
And themselves.
You know, I mean, it all depends because it's people, you know. I mean, you have people who want to be left alone. You have people that are just looking for a place to camp and be left alone. You have predators. It is, you know, like any place else when you're alone out on the street, you know? I mean, it's dangerous. There's predators. You're vulnerable.
That's Tim Harris, homeless advocate and the founder of the street newspaper Real Change. Also talking about this homeless encampment, the jungle, is Seattle's mayor. Last night, after that multiple fatal shooting in that area, Mayor Ed Murray said the jungle was next on his list for cleanups of unauthorized homeless encampments.
Is that one of the things we have to do is we have to go into these encampments on state right-of-way, offer people services, clean the place up, and try and get people out. This area was actually marked for that process tomorrow.
Tomorrow, meaning today. This was Murray speaking last night. He said the jungle is exactly the kind of place he and the city want to clean up with the goal of getting people out of unauthorized encampments and into shelters or housing. And Murray called on Seattle to come together to address homelessness, not to retreat to a polarized conversation. Homeless advocate Tim Harris echoed that call. He says this shooting could put fuel on the fire for people who think all homeless people are criminals.
To me, it seems more about gun violence than homelessness. You know, this is something that could have happened whether or not they were living in the jungle or not. This could have happened at Cafe Racer. This could have happened at a house on Capitol Hill.
Harris says most homeless people are not criminals. In fact, many of them are more vulnerable to violence and crime. Harris says services and outreach like the mayor is proposing are needed in unauthorized camps like the jungle as long as the process is fair and consistent. But Harris says the bottom line is not everybody wants to live inside. And some of the people living in camps like the jungle should be allowed to live outside if they want to.
And their right to do that, you know, stops where they are infringing on other folks. You know, I mean, if they're involved in criminal activity, if they are a problem for the neighborhood, if they're causing problems with trash and fires, then those are problems that need to be dealt with. But, you know, in a city where we are only able to offer shelter to about one in every three people who need it, we need to recognize that people need to be somewhere and that it's not helpful for us to just chase them around and criminalize them.
Tim Harris, founder of the street newspaper Real Change. And you can see photos of this homeless encampment, the jungle, at our website, KUOW.org. For more on this topic, some context and some talk about solutions is Q13 Fox political analyst C.R. Douglas with us all this hour. C.R., again, for those who just tuned in, five people shot, at least two killed in this homeless encampment in Soto. How does last night's shooting affect the debate that we happen to be having right now over what to do about homelessness?
Well, I think it's going to affect it greatly, and I think it's a wake-up call, especially for the mayor. You know, it was a big coincidence that as the shooting was happening, literally as the shooting was happening, the mayor was giving a primetime speech on television about the subject of homelessness. And he repeated his call for more federal and state money. We've heard that before. But he said something last night that I think was newsworthy and I think will be important as this plays out, which is the system for delivering homeless services is broken.
How so?
The city contracts out with all kinds of different providers, and it is too fragmented. It's too wrought with politics. We have too many programs that aren't proving their worth. We're spending $50 million a year at the city level, and the problem is only getting worse, not better. He says, and we will see if this plays out, that he wants to overhaul the system, change it, make it work.
How hard would that be?
Very hard.
Why?
Because he didn't say this, but you hear people whisper this. We have a homeless service industrial complex. We have an ingrained bureaucracy. And I'm not talking about the city bureaucracy necessarily. I'm talking about all these nonprofits that really do the lion's share of the services we contract out. And all those different agencies, and there are dozens, probably 100, are providing different services. They've all got their own sort of executive.
What are we
directors.
Talking? Meals?
Meals.
Shelters.
Counseling.
Mm-hmm.
Job referral programs. Mm-hmm. You know, long-term housing, short-term housing, overnight housing, you name it. Veterans housing, family housing, women's housing, all kinds of stuff. But it's very fragmented, and it's fraught with a lot of entrenched interests. They've been around for a long time. They've got a lot of sway at City Hall. And you get a system which has grown up to have a lot of inefficiencies in it. And the mayor is admitting that very publicly. And he's unlikely to get a ton more money from the feds and the state. He may, we'll see, but he has the power to change how the city spends the $50 million it does annually. And if he can wring a lot of inefficiencies out of the system, we could get better outcomes and hopefully avoid things like last night.
Does this have to do with the powers he's taken for himself by declaring homeless to be an emergency? Or are we talking just he's a strong mayor and he can knock heads?
Well, it doesn't directly relate. I mean, just emergency powers doesn't give you the chance to, like, blow up the homeless system. But the fact that he declared an emergency suggests he wants to do big things here. And so I think it's just an example of his boldness. I mean, listen, this guy does big things. He did minimum wage. That was huge. He did this big, huge housing recommendation, you know, extracted a ton from developers. He did a huge transportation package. He clearly wants this to be the next thing he looks at. He wants to make a huge dent in this problem, and part of that is changing the way the system works.
So ultimately, does that mean he's got to get his city council members vote their votes lined up? And where is he on that?
I think absolutely, but you do hear whispers, and stronger than whispers, among council members that they agree that there's a little bit of a sense of they're kind of held hostage by some of the way the system works. And so every year they're sort of giving more and more money, and they're getting worse outcomes. Homelessness is twice as bad as it was 10 years ago, and we are investing two, probably three times as much. So the numbers show that it's a mess and it's got to change. Yes, more money is needed, and the mayor recognizes that. But this is his Nixon to China moment.
What do you mean by that?
This is a chance for a progressive who has credentials with this kind of community to say, hey, we got to change the way it works. A sort of, you know, a Mark Sidran or, you know, one of those guys couldn't do it, right?
Right. They're already perceived as heartless by some people.
You need a leftist. Yeah. You need a guy that's proven progressive to say, hey, this homeless delivery system's got to change.
Okay, so we've talked about the mayor, city council members, and this, as you call it, a bureaucracy. We haven't said anything about the Seattle residents who are complaining these days about tent encampments, crime, drug dealing, prostitution, RV parking lots, services in the neighborhoods. How powerful are the people of his city?
Well, they're very powerful, and you don't do a primetime speech if you aren't partly pushed by the loud communities. I think this whole jungle tragedy is going to feed their outrage. We told you so. These places are a hotbed of criminal activity. You've got to do something. And the mayor certainly is responding, but certainly before even yesterday, is responding to that. You know, he's set up what will be three RV sites so that the campers will have a place to concentrate. That'll be monitored. There'll be sanitation services. There'll be even outreach by
caseworkers. Yeah.
Yeah. So the communities are being heard, and there has been a response to the complaints.
Okay. So in case you've just joined us, we're talking about last night's shooting in this homeless encampment, the jungle in Sodo. We're talking about the mayor's primetime speech last night and the future of attacking this issue of homelessness, the growing issue in Seattle. Any takeaway? We've said a lot. What's, you know, boil this down. Where are we today? What have we learned? What should we be looking for?
Well, one thing that's going to be brought up is, should a sweep have happened in the jungle, you know, earlier? And as the mayor says, it was planned for today. He's getting a lot of pushback from sweeps. He's very sensitive on the topic of sweeps. Sweeps have a bad rap. Mayors have done it in the past. He claims it's different, though. And what he's trying to do when he's sweeping, as he's changing the system and all the rest, is saying, yes, you've got to leave this area, but here's a service provider you can go to. Here's some housing the city offers. Here's a place you can store your stuff. I mean, the point he's making is we're not just evicting people. No. We're trying to kind of refer them to other places. But whether he can do that without just being tagged the sweeper, I don't know. He's very defensive on the subject. And it's hard to be removing people without getting the tag that you're just sweeping them and you don't care.
We're talking with Q13 political analyst C.R. Douglas, Fox Q13. And still to come on the show, why does it matter who replaces, which liberal replaces the liberal Jim McDermott in Congress? What's going on at the National Wildlife Refuge? We're going to talk with an Oregon reporter who's there. That and more coming up. Schools all over your state are experiencing teacher shortages. And why? Well, partly it may be because of initiatives meant to improve education. So it's the voters' fault?
Full-day kindergarten, that legislation means doubling the number of kindergartens that there were 6-7 years ago. It also means with lower class sizes in first and second grade that in many cases that's an additional teacher as well.
We'll talk with a principal and a teacher about what teacher shortages mean for them. That's in about 20 minutes on KUOW's The Record. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. This hour, talking with Q13 Fox political analyst C.R. Douglas. Good afternoon, C.R.
Good afternoon.
We're going to talk about voting here, because 2016 was already going to be a big voting year in Washington, even before a 14-term congressman announces his retirement. So now, on top of electing a president and a governor, with Jim McDermott leaving, Seattle area voters are going to be replacing a so-called congressman for life. Candidates so far, a pair of state lawmakers, an art gallery owner, and a King County councilman. Chair of the county council, James Joseph McDermott. First of all, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you.
Right off the top, let's get this out of the way. You have the same first and last name as the guy who's retiring. How much is that going to help you?
You know, I'm running on my 15 years of experience in elective office in the legislature in the county. And, you know, I'm Joe McDermott, and I'll be running as Joe McDermott.
Didn't cross your mind? No advantage? Not a factor?
Something of a factor, but that's not what this is about. This is about the work I've done and what I want to do in Congress.
Let's talk about the work you want to do. This is Seattle. So really, the question is, what kind of Democrat are you?
I'm a strong progressive Democrat. Come from the party. I'm a former chair of the 34th District Democrats.
Let's make it simple for listeners. Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton?
Hillary Clinton.
Easy. Let me ask you this. What is more important to you as an elected official, compromising to get things done or taking a stand for what you strongly believe?
I don't think it's a binary choice. There are times when taking that stand and pushing the envelope are really important. I tell interest groups that I work with closely that sometimes it's their job to make me uncomfortable as their champion. And I won't stretch and get as much for them if they always tell me I'm doing a great job and don't ask for more.
Why Clinton, not Sanders?
I think Hillary Clinton has an exceptional pool of experience that she brings and has been a strong progressive voice throughout her career. And I look forward to her shattering the glass ceiling.
What do you say to a Seattle voter who says Hillary Clinton, not full-throated enough, not a strong enough voice?
I think it's excellent that Sanders is raising issues like that in this campaign, a minimum wage, paid sick leave, all kinds of progressive issues that we as a party need to be talking about and that I have led on and will lead on as a member of Congress.
What are your priorities? What do you want to get done in Congress?
You know, first of all, I think in order to be successful in Congress on progressive values, we need to overturn Citizens United. We have a campaign finance system that is beyond broken. And then I think we have the opportunity to really cash in on a historic breakthrough on progressive legislation, an economy that really works for everyone, paid sick leave, $15 minimum wage, environmental policy that really sets our nation up as a leader on climate change, and a healthcare policy that covers all Americans.
Right now, you'd be in the minority, and some people say a predictable member of the minority, that almost it's Seattle. Who needs to listen to the congressman from Seattle? We know what he or she's going to say. How do you deal in that environment?
I talk about it as I did in Olympia, in working both in Olympia and on the council, in working across the aisle. It doesn't matter whether you're in the majority or the minority. It's building relationships and knowing people and achieving success, garnering Republican support for transgender protections in our hate crime statutes.
And what do you know about building relationships in Washington, D.C.?
That it's truly no different than building relationships anywhere else. And I've done that successfully at the county council, where I've served for the last 5 years, and in Olympia, where I was a legislator for a decade.
Why should I vote for you instead of the people you're running against? How are you better?
I bring 15 years of experience in legislative environments that my opponents don't carry with them. And achieving progressive results successfully in those situations.
You are one of nine people on the county council, the chair, but one of nine. Why would you want to be one of 435 people in the U.S. House of Representatives?
You know, it is a challenging place, but it's an opportunity to make real change for not only our congressional district, but for the country.
Let's see, it's 2016. How old are you?
48.
How many terms are you in this for?
You know, I'm worried about winning this one at this point in time.
Because the last guy did 14. I mean, you could be a congressman for life.
I would not expect to do that, but I would want to do this job and invest in it, yes.
We're talking with Joe McDermott here, chair of the King County Council, running for the 7th District to replace Jim McDermott as your U.S. Congress member. What do you want to tell people listening to you right now about you?
I want to tell them that I've served in the state legislature and the county council for the last 15 years, achieving progressive results. And I believe I can take that success with me to Congress and represent the 7th Congressional District effectively at a point in time when I think our nation is truly poised to cash in on historic progressive change ourselves.
We've all heard about the incredible partisanship, supposedly a poisonous atmosphere in Congress. How would you deal with that?
You know, I think in large part that comes from our campaign finance system, which is truly broken in this country. And that's why my first pledge is to work to overturn Citizens United. We need to be able to take big money, big corporations out of being able to really buy our democracy. And then I think the stage is cleared to be able to take up those progressive changes.
Joe McDermott, running for Congress, U.S. Congress. Good to talk with you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Bill.
King County Council Chair, former state representative, former state senator, Joe McDermott, running to replace Jim McDermott, no relation. I'm Bill Radke with Q13 Fox political analyst C.R. Douglas. C.R., I'm sure he wishes we would stop asking, but I'm going to get it out of the way at the top because it's so unusual. Same name as the congressman, how much does it matter?
And almost the same first name.
Oh, yeah. His name is James Joseph. He goes by Joe.
Listen, it's huge. I mean, campaigns are spend so much of their time creating name recognition. That is part and parcel of what you do in a campaign. Joe McDermott does not have to do that. There has been a McDermott on the ballot in the 7th District for 20 years. And in a low turnout August primary, where people aren't paying much attention, where a lot of people don't even know Jim McDermott has retired, listen, McDermott on the ballot, that's going to be a huge benefit for him.
Okay, let's talk about who he faces and why I should care. We'll get to that in a moment. He said Hillary, not Bernie. Who do you think that helps, based on who's in this campaign?
Well, two other sort of notable contenders. One is Brady Walkinshaw. He's a state representative from the 43rd, kind of the Capitol Hill area. A gay man, a Cuban-American. Checks a couple boxes. He's not been there for very long, just a couple years in the state legislature, but was involved in kind of international relief work. He was with the Gates Foundation, not as well known as the others, but he comes with a lot of kind of power behind that Gates Foundation work and the people there. So he's raised more money than any of the others, but he has an uphill battle in terms of just name recognition and just his years of service. The third and really final first-tier candidate is Pramila Jayapal. She's a state senator from South Seattle, very, very well-respected, did a ton of work on immigrant rights, women's rights, started One America, a big statewide immigrants' rights group and refugee rights. I think at this point she's pretty clearly the front runner. I mean, even with Jim McDermott's name, she just comes with a lot of organizational skill and a lot of background. Interestingly, she's endorsing Bernie Sanders. So there is kind of a difference if you just look at that as a litmus test. She also was a strong supporter of Shama Sawant. So she's got a lot of kind of socialist leanings, and this could end up hurting her. I mean, people don't quite realize, they think of Jim McDermott and they think this is the bluest district there ever was.
It's changed. It literally has been redistricted.
It's not as blue a district as it used to be, and it's a lot of northern communities. So you have Kenmore, Shoreline, Edmonds. These are not bastions of socialism. These are not bastions of sort of Bernie Sanders area. So her kind of extreme end of the left spectrum could work against her.
Now, as I said, why should I care? Why should I, the voter, care which stripe of liberal is predictably going to represent the Seattle area in Congress?
I think it's probably not about which stripe of liberal, because they all probably are pretty similar if you go down kind of the litmus test of minimum wage and paid sick leave and all the rest. I think voters probably should look at who is gonna be best at building bridges. I mean, you talked about that with Joe McDermott. It is inevitable. Inevitable is maybe too strong, but very likely that Democrats stay in the minority for several years, several more cycles. So you're talking about
we have very gerrymandered, safe districts. There's just not a lot of movement.
So you're talking about electing a Democrat from a blue district, and to get something done, who's got the best track record of building those bridges? You don't just want someone who's great at kind of pontificating about liberal causes. I mean, in some ways, that's what McDermott's done, certainly the last several years. You know, kind of people feel like he's sort of phoned it in. But to get something done, who builds bridges? There are so many things that this district needs. I mean, when you look at I-5 is at the end of its life. It needs a huge overhaul.
That scares me every time people say that. But yes,
there is no money for I-5. Look at the infrastructure needs, you know, the airport infrastructure needs, the seaport infrastructure needs. Sound Transit's looking for a huge infusion of cash next year. I mean, there's all kinds of federal help that are needed in this district. And the person that's going to bring more home, and that's one way to judge this role, is the person who's going to be able to build bridges. And so I think voters need to assess it on those terms.
So that's what we mean when we talk about McDermott and McDermott. If you're in the Seattle, and as you said, north of that, Edmonds, Kenmore, et cetera, district, you're gonna have to figure out who's going to be your next member of Congress. And we just talked about some of what's at stake for the Seattle area, what the Seattle area is looking for from Washington, D.C. And that was Q13 Fox political analyst C.R. Douglas with us all this hour on KUOW. Now, voters in Washington have also got to think about a presidential election and all the big issues that candidates are debating now. One of the biggest is national security in an age of an international refugee crisis and terrorist threats from ISIS. Here is what Nate in the University District has to say about national security.
I got a little daughter, and it's kind of like the monster in the bed. Like, if I can't see it, it can't see me. It kind of seems like, oh, hey, if we just keep them over there, you know, don't bring, you know, refugees in here or let Europe deal with it, it's going to go away. I don't think it is going to go away. I think, you know, as a nation that can do some stuff, we should do some stuff. And that stuff, I think, is, you know, helping out, and you're really going after and getting rid of some people who are terrorists, I guess you would say.
Here's one more Seattle resident, Ryan Samsell, what he had to say about national security.
The government is doing a lot to protect us from terrorism, but they're not doing enough to protect us from violence, because the majority of violence occurs in situations like domestic violence, right? I think we spend a lot of money on making sure people don't take down planes, and that's great, and we should, but that's not where most people die.
What does national security mean to you right now this election year? Call us at 206-221-3663 and tell us your story. Where are you coming from on this? 221-3663. Join the conversation on Twitter right now. Use the hashtag #electionfeels. This is KUOW. Back in a moment. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. You know, perhaps, that authorities have arrested Ammon Bundy, the leader of the militant group occupying the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in eastern Oregon. That arrest came after a showdown with the FBI that left one militant dead and a number of others in custody. Now, the FBI has set up checkpoints leading into the refuge, and agents have surrounded the remaining militants still inside. Reporter John Sepulvado is with Oregon Public Broadcasting, and he told me that even though Ammon Bundy was arrested along with other leaders, the standoff goes on.
Well, right now I'm estimating, and this is I've spent all night with the militants, I'm estimating between 7 and 12 militants remain. Only one of them was in the inner circle, a man named Jason Patrick. He was not expecting things to turn out the way they were. I had just talked to him a few days prior, and he believed that the federal government wouldn't do anything. So he's in a bit of shock. And the folks who are left are, to just put it bluntly, these are people who didn't make it to the inner circle for one reason or another. And frankly, they come from desperate situations, often economically. I know that a few have expressed that they might have mental health problems. So these are not folks that are easy necessarily to reason with to begin with. Take on top of it that they have like a very strong ideology and strong belief for what they're doing. And they feel that they're the ones who have been chosen to take a stand. So right now we're not expecting a peaceful resolution at this point at any time in the near future.
What are they saying about their willingness to resort to violence here?
They've made it very clear that they're willing to do it and that they're willing to die. Right now, as we're speaking, and well into tomorrow, they're going to be building fortifications using federal equipment. I saw them using backhoes. They were making it very clear that they do not fear the idea of death. And a large part, too, is one of the men who died, one of the leaders, Lavoy Finicum. He was the second in command, and he was with Ammon Bundy's convoy when it was stopped by police, and he's the one we've confirmed that is dead. He was very, very popular among this particular group of people who were there. One of the men, his name is David Fry, he's 27 years old. He came from Ohio. He has significant problems in his life. And he was befriended by Lavoy Finicum, and David Fry, who earlier said he didn't want to hurt anybody, is now vowing and swearing to kill anybody who comes in to avenge Lavoy Finicum, and he has a gun. So while it might be rancorous talk, it might be dramatic talk, he still has the opportunity to do it if somebody engages.
What do you know about what law enforcement plans to do next?
It's pretty clear that law enforcement is ready for the long haul. And the reason I say that is because while we were waiting to leave this area, we saw bucket trucks. These are the kinds of trucks that work on electric lines. We saw porta potties. We saw warmers. We saw snow plows. It did not look like they were going in to fight the remnants of this self-proclaimed militia. It looked like they were going to set up a camp. It looked like they were going to be there for a long time. And so I have not confirmed this with FBI, but just by the looks of it, they look like they're going to squeeze them out. They're going to set up a perimeter, they're going to have stations there, and they're going to wait for them to come out one by one. And I'm not saying that that is going to be the case, but I'm saying that that's awful. That, based on what I saw, that's my inclination. FBI, of course, is not commenting on any strategy they're employing.
That's reporter John Sepulvado with Oregon Public Broadcasting. We talked to him just a little bit ago. Some witnesses say this man who was killed by police, Lavoy Finicum, had charged at authorities during the arrest, but others say that he complied with orders. The FBI is saying these armed militants were given ample opportunity to peacefully leave the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. The special agent in charge says that enforcement is working to safely remove people still occupying that site. This is KUOW Seattle. We'll keep you posted. At KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. Good afternoon. In the news today, your state legislature has been trying to fix the education system here for years, and then this year they get a new challenge to deal with, a teacher shortage. School principal Adam Couch says he has never seen a shortage like this before. He's at Dick Scobee Elementary in Auburn. He thinks one reason the teacher shortage is so bad is that voters approved that initiative requiring lower class sizes,
which basically means additional classes being opened up in most buildings. So full-day kindergarten, that legislation means doubling the number of kindergartens that there were 6-7 years ago. It also means with lower class sizes in first and second grade that in many cases that's an additional teacher as well, and that the universities aren't producing the same volume of teachers as the demand is requesting.
So that's the demand for more full-time teachers, but also this school in Auburn, Dick Scobee Grade School, sees a big demand for subs. The principal, Adam Couch, says classrooms in his school need substitute teachers 2 to 3 times a week on average. And on those days, Couch says he's got 45 minutes to figure out what to do with the students before they start to show up.
Whether it means canceling PE music or library, whether it means taking teachers during their normal planning time and having them go down and basically supervise for 45-minute blocks. And for those kids who don't have the teacher or sub, that means they're probably not really getting intended instruction for the day. It's busy work. And the other alternative is that we take that group of kids and we divide them into 3 or 4 other classes, and they kind of get assimilated into those other groups. And so that impact not only then is on the class that doesn't have the sub, but on the classes who do have their teacher.
So what can we do about this teacher shortage? Well, there's a bill in Olympia right now to promote alternate routes to teaching. You heard Adam Couch talk about how not enough teachers are coming through universities. This bill in the legislature would promote ways to get a teaching certificate besides traditional master's degree. Now, for a teacher's perspective on this, we turn to Nate Gibbs Bowling, who is the 2016 Washington State Teacher of the Year. He teaches AP Government and Human Geography at Lincoln High School in Tacoma, where there is a shortage. And he says one problem is we do not value teachers enough.
Over the last few years, policymakers have made being a teacher really difficult, and being a teacher has become a position that some people see as being less desirable. A lot of teachers have their work dictated to them and feel like they don't have autonomy. And if you compound that with not being treated like a professional and low pay, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Why don't we value teachers more than that?
A lot of it has to do with just a disposition within the population about the profession. If you look at a teacher, say somebody who teaches computer science, that person could leave the teaching profession and go work for any of the tech companies in Seattle and double their salary instantly. We take teachers for granted.
It seems counterintuitive. Like, what's more important to parents than their kids? What would be more important to society? We're going to have kids. Why would we have this attitude toward our teachers of all people?
Because we just count on teachers and teachers are always there, they're honestly just taken for granted by society. And one of the things I think is really problematic is that basically all teachers are treated the same, and all teachers aren't the same. Some teachers are more effective. Some teachers get better results with kids, but we treat all teachers the same.
How can we get the most out of our best teachers? What do you advocate?
One of the things that I would really like to see happen is more autonomy in exchange for accountability. We know that our highest need schools need our most effective teachers. But what our most effective teachers don't need is to have the work that they're going to do dictated to them. What I would really like to see in Washington State is for policymakers to move towards a system where we basically encourage our most effective teachers to go to our highest need schools and then leave them alone. Don't add new mandates to their work. Don't make their work harder. Like, support them. Make their work easier. Workload for teachers is a huge issue. I have a friend down in Vancouver who has an 8-period day, which means she's an English teacher with 200 students. 200 students, Bill. 200 students. Think about the grading. Think about the kind of feedback a student gets when a teacher is trying to grade 200 essays.
Well, what you call mandates to teachers, other people call that high standards and rules. And give me an example of a mandate to a teacher that you think is wrong-headed.
Sure. So one of the things that I'll say is a lot of the accountability measures that have been introduced in the last couple of years, like the evaluation system we have right now, which is intended to identify low-performing teachers, actually makes the work of high-performing teachers more difficult and more time-consuming. I hear horror stories online from teachers who are doing their evaluation, and their evaluation packet with their principal ends up going 60 pages back and forth. If a principal and a teacher are working on a 60-page evaluation, that means that they're not working on lesson planning, they're not working on making new curriculum, they're not working on introducing new resources into their teaching. They're working on an evaluation.
You said that the underlying problem is we don't value teachers. That's not something we can legislate. How do we get there?
One of the things that needs to happen is that teachers need to tell their stories. I get frustrated very often when I read reports from education reporters that don't include teacher voice in them. Like, teachers need to seize the narrative back on education and tell the stories of success we're having.
What's the story you want to tell?
Well, I work at Lincoln High School, and Lincoln High School is the highest poverty high school in Pierce County. And down at my high school, we've transformed the culture of the building. We've created a college-going culture. Over 80% of our students are graduating on time, and nearly half of our students are taking an AP class, a college-level class, in the high school. Like, that's a success story. Our building essentially has some of the highest poverty populations in the state of Washington, and we're getting results commensurate with a suburban school, and we're on the rise, and it's getting better every year. Like, that's the story that's happening here at Lincoln High School, and that same story is happening in Tukwila Foster High School. That same story is happening at Rainier Beach in South Seattle.
That is the 2016 Teacher of the Year we were just talking with, Nate Gibbs Bowling in Tacoma. He teaches AP Government and Human Geography at Lincoln High School in Tacoma. We're talking also with Q13 Fox political analyst C.R. Douglas. And C.R., on top of all the challenges we have educating our kids in Washington State, what are the odds we provide more teachers?
Not great. I mean, the state legislature is already in noncompliance, in contempt for not fully funding basic education. And that has to do with just compensating current teachers at an appropriate level. So this is a crisis that everyone is calling a crisis, but it doesn't seem like it's going to be able to get much attention because they've got a larger crisis and a larger Supreme Court mandate that, in a way, is in front of this in the queue.
Yeah, we just heard that teacher talking about the need for more teachers, but also higher pay for teachers. So you think that's just not happening?
Well, it's being proposed. I mean, the legislature is looking at this, and they are aware that they've got this shortage problem, and it kind of falls on party lines. The Democrats, the governor, have proposed increasing pay, increasing starting pay, increasing pay for everyone as a way to attract more people into the profession, keep more people. They're talking about signing bonuses. They're talking about forgiving people's student loans who are going into the profession to encourage them to choose teaching. They'll relieve their loans that they're burdened by. So there's a lot of sort of money being talked about. On the Republican side, you have things that were mentioned a little bit, which are relaxing some of the requirements. There is some red tape. It's in some ways too hard for retirees to go back into the classroom. We make it hard for people who were certified in other states to come and get into a classroom. We make it tough for alternative routes to the classroom. I mean, let's say someone has a great track record in an industry and can walk in and do a science class, but they haven't gone through the typical science certification. Well, we don't allow that. So I think you're going to see actually more rule changes, more policy relaxation, if you will, as opposed to money. There just isn't enough money down Olympia to add to this, but I think there is probably some room to do what the Republicans are pushing, and Democrats aren't necessarily resisting some of these alternative policy changes.
Even if it means a fight with unions? Is that what you're talking about in part?
I think, yes. I think there'll be some resistance with unions, but I think the crisis is so large that there will be, I think, some kind of action. You know, it's not just that it's you know, tough on teachers, and that's a real conflict and problem. But there's pretty clear evidence that the student test scores for kids who are in classes that don't have permanent teachers are much less. I mean, we are hurting students pretty clearly and pretty dramatically by not having consistent teachers in a lot of these classrooms.
And don't Republicans generally also want us to give kids more choice and parents more choice with charter schools?
Charters is what actually is getting most of the attention. I think charters will kind of get rescued. And there's a lot of, you know, because they were overturned by the Supreme Court. There's a lot of people that are cynical about that. There's a lot of people that say, hey, you know, why were you so quick to rescue charters, which serve about 1,000 students, maybe 1,300, when you are still not answering the Supreme Court mandate for the million students, you know, who are in the regular public schools?
How correct was that school principal in Auburn when he says, when he, I think, blames is fair from his point of view, blames the voters for passing an initiative that calls for smaller class sizes?
Well, I think that's part of it, but the Supreme Court also has mandated smaller class sizes, so it wasn't just the voters. But yes, all-day kindergarten, small class sizes, that is creating this teacher crunch problem. I would add to it one more thing. The Great Recession delayed a lot of retirements. A lot of people that were kind of age and got so hit, you know, in their 401ks and others that they chose to delay their retirement. So you're having a surge of retirements now that we haven't seen in a generation. And that is opening up a lot of space that's very, very hard to fill.
You mean retiring teachers?
Absolutely.
Yeah. C.R. Douglas is a political analyst with Q13 Fox with us all this hour, listening to the news, providing some context, telling you a lot of the stuff that he knows. That's why it's good to see you here. Back in a moment, talking about news from Canada on KUOW's The Record. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Good afternoon. Thanks for tuning in. Police officer shoots lightly armed immigrant is not convicted of murder. It's happened in Pasco, Washington, and elsewhere in the United States, and in Toronto, Canada, where this week a jury returned its verdict. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Good to talk to you, Bill. This is a strange case and one that Canadians are still scratching their heads over the day after the verdict.
What happened on that Toronto streetcar?
Yeah, so it was Toronto streetcar, summer of 2013, a young man, 18 years old, out of control, stoned on ecstasy and armed with a switchblade, and a police officer tries to subdue him, fails, and shoots him. Nine shots in two separate volleys, and that matters, kills him. The whole thing is caught on a YouTube video, which is posted almost immediately, so the story takes on the kind of drama that you get on these things, and it's taken a while for the case to work its way through the courts. It's a jury verdict, Bill, and in Canada, juries are not allowed to say anything about their reasons for doing anything, so we have a verdict. The prosecutors gave the jury two choices, second-degree murder or manslaughter, or attempted murder.
Yes, could this officer get convicted of attempted murder when the gunshots killed Sami Yateem?
Yes. So they did, as you say, attempted murder. The consensus that has emerged from people who followed the trial closely and listened to the arguments from both sides is that the jury concluded that the officer, given the circumstances, was entitled to use deadly force. And shot him. But the second volley of shots, so the first volley of shots is three, the fellow is then down on the floor of the streetcar, dying, and the officer, after a pause of about 11 seconds, shoots him six more times. That was excessive. So these charges are a blunt instrument. They don't cover all circumstances, but the general feeling of court watchers is that the jury concluded that the officer was justified in the circumstances to use some deadly force, but that what he did was excessive, and that's why they convicted him of attempted murder.
Let's get some context here, Vaughn. In the United States, we are highly aware of police officers' questionable use of force, especially against racial minorities. But how big an issue is this in Canada right now?
Oh, I would say it's a very, very divisive issue. People on the left think the verdict is either ridiculous or inadequate. And on the right, they say that, look, the police officer is justified in using force when someone's out of control on drugs and armed with a switchblade, and that people don't understand the kind of pressures on officers. Head of the Toronto Police Officers Union is saying this will have a chilling effect on policing. The officer, James Forcillo, has been suspended with pay. The verdict will be appealed. There's no sentence yet. We don't know we've got the verdict, but we don't have the sentence. That won't come till May. There will be appeals. The Toronto Police Force have already gone through an inquiry process on this bill, and changed a lot of their procedures. There was 84 recommendations. They say that they're going to respond differently in the future, but it's a divisive verdict, but I think a reminder, and I'm sure Americans have been through some of these cases as well, a reminder of just how difficult these cases are. This one was exceptionally difficult.
We've been talking with Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer about the attempted murder conviction, not the murder conviction, of this officer who killed a Syrian immigrant in Toronto on a streetcar that had been emptied of people. You can easy to find the, as you said, the cell phone, the YouTube video. Vaughn, thank you for joining us.
Bye-bye, Bill.
KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke here, as we've been all this hour, with Q13 Fox political analyst C.R. Douglas. You're analyzing not only local politics, and we've been talking a lot of that, but we keep asking the question, will this finally hurt Donald Trump? Now he's not even going to be in the debate that he's been the star of over and over?
Yeah, and those of us covering it tomorrow night are very, very upset because he's such a great person to cover and such a great addition to those debates as a journalist. I do think it's an odd choice and could potentially, you know, hurt him. I mean, he's so far ahead that I don't think it's going to be fatal. But
so our listeners know, he backed out complaining about one of the moderators,
right,
the Fox moderator.
Right. Now, he changes his mind daily, so he may show up on stage tomorrow night. Who knows? But the debates have worked out so well for him up to now, so it seems super odd that he would take himself out of that. And it's given fodder, which is getting traction, it seems to me, from the opponents who said, you're scared of Megyn Kelly? You know, you're going to have to deal with ISIS.
You're having to deal with Vladimir Putin.
I mean, Megyn Kelly? She's a great journalist and tough questions. But so it's giving them a lot of room to say, hey, you seem to be scared of something that makes you look like a wimp. You're scared in front of Iowa voters. We'll see. His assumption is that it'll kill ratings. With his departure, it'll be interesting if it doesn't. What does he do if they still have ratings when he's not there?
Yeah, we keep saying, well, did he finally shoot himself in the foot? And it's never happened so far. Q13 Fox political analyst C.R. Douglas, and thanks for sitting in all this hour and just really filling us in on what's going on behind the scenes of the issues we've been covering today.
It was a pleasure.
We're live tweeting the show at all times. Join us on Twitter @KUOW, and of course we're on Facebook too. I'm Bill Radke with C.R. Douglas. Thanks for tuning in.